For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable. That's right. For the record, you ain't trying to grow, then it's done for you. That's right. For the record, lab on me going all the way. All the way. For the record, ain't trying to link, no time to waste. Stop calling. For the record, 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 for the record. For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable. That's right.
Welcome to The Clink, coming to you live from the Mount Woodgie Studios here in Currumbin. Today's guest is someone very different to anyone we've had on the show before. He's a second commando out of the 2nd Commando Regiment. His name is H. H, welcome to The Clink.
Thanks. Great to be here, Simo.
24 years you've served in our military. At the top, you worked extremely hard to get there and deployed many, many, many times. For the people out there, let's take them on a journey, H, and introduce them to who you are and your story of redemption here today on The Clink.
Sure. So I joined the military when I was 17 years old, a little bit after 17 years old. And ever since I can remember as a young fella, I always wanted to join. Not only did I want to join the army specifically, I always, as far back as I can remember, as in basically since I could walk, I always wanted to join the special forces. And I'm not sure where that motivation came from, as in I didn't have anyone directly in my family. But I do remember that quite clearly, and that kind of never ever changed. So at 17, I actually tried to join a little bit earlier but couldn't. So at 17, I put my, shortly thereafter, put my paperwork in and was accepted. And then went down to Brisbane, signed the dotted line and off to basic training. And then the rest was quickly history.
You're a country boy?
Yep. Born and bred in Toowoomba.
Mate, what was school like? Were you really sort of, regimented within the way that you went about yourself?
Yeah, definitely. I had a funny schooling period, I guess you'd call it. And not dislike many of... Yeah, I don't like to stereotype it, but us types. And what do I mean by that? I found school, boring almost, or I'd make excitement, which generally would lead to trouble. But I wasn't silly or dumb, I did advanced maths and didn't even apply myself to it and pass. So, I had a brain. I just didn't maybe the focus. Even though I'm focused, but it just didn't interest me, I liked school for, the girls. I liked school for a bit of sport. I liked school for a few fights. And when I look back and you say, what did you like about school? And that's kind of the memories that I like, having a good scrap after school or anything like that. But as far as sitting in the classroom, I don't recall ever really enjoying that. And... in fact, I could never ever wait to get out of the classroom. It was more about lunchtimes or before school or after school.
Were you athletic?
Yeah, I guess I was actually. I always played club sports. I played soccer, footy, cricket, all the way through to probably my early teens. And then I think it was an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie that inspired me to start lifting weights. Yeah. Believe it or not, and yeah. I know it sounds a bit cliche, but I can't remember which particular one it was, but. Then I just started living in, right from a young age, as in probably about 14, 15, I just started living in gyms. And that's where all, I didn't realise it at the time, I had some anger issues and some other things already going on. And that was my therapy. But like I said, I didn't realise what I was doing it for back then. I just knew, it made me feel better. A lot of time in the gym, mate.
Did you come from a good home, mum and dad? Was it all good? Or when you say anger issues, and yeah. I don't want to pride too much into the family history, but I think it's important to set a little bit of a scene of who you are and the direction that you're headed in life. Mm.
I didn't have a bad upbringing, but there were parts of it that I've certainly learnt later in life that have had an impact on me. So when I was young, and when I say young, I'm about 6 years old or something, my parents did separate. Right. So I had very little to no contact with my father for many years, as in 10 or 15 years. Yep. He was still trying to contact me. However, without going on the finer details, but, you know, there was some other things obviously going on in the background. And then my mother was with another partner who then became my stepfather for a period of time. And, you know, I can remember a time where we had a good relationship, and then I can remember a time where it was pretty not good, and there was a few things going on there. And definitely those things, again, not realising at the time, but now I've had a lot of time to reflect and done a lot of psychology and counselling, as in, you know, with myself and support and other things, to try and sort of unmap my mind a little bit. You know, the more you understand yourself, the better I think you can deal with yourself. And yeah, there's certainly some stuff there that I wasn't even really aware of, you know, but when you get asked all these questions by, you know, those people with a piece of paper on the wall, you know, they work out, you know, what was going on or why. I call us trauma babies, and I'm pretty sort of comfortable with that term because it's just an open generic term, and I use that term with others because what I found, and I think that what certainly makes it more, you know, palatable, to use a flash word, as in comfortable with ourselves, is almost every motherfucker I know who's like half crazy but in a fucking good way. So like all the unit guys, all the guys I consider like my brothers.
Yeah.
And like, I mean fucking brothers. Like, they call you, I'll be there with a bottle of tequila and a fucking shovel. I won't even ask what for. Every single fucking one of those guys is a trauma baby. I don't have a single fucking bro who fucking didn't have something fucked up in his childhood.
It's
just a level of fucking extremity, you know what I mean?
I'll just quickly touch on it. I don't want to talk about myself. I'm here to talk about you. But in relation to that, you know, I was a sexually abused child, physically abused, grew up on the streets, foster homes, boys' homes and jails. So for me, you know, that trauma from an abusive upbringing was extremely weighed heavy. And, you know, then joining clubs and you know, violence and you know, feeling fucking dominant because I'd been sort of made so little.
And
it wasn't until 30 something years later where I'd done some soul searching and I realised I, at that time, was just a little boy trapped inside this strong man's body with a lot of attitude and a lot of anger, not willing to let a fucking soul come within kooey of me, you know.
And I can totally relate to that. And that, you know, there's a couple of things going on there. You know, what I've learnt now is, and like I said, I totally relate to this. There's some similarities there. So what we do, and most people would, you know this, but as you learn when you're going through all this process, is, you know, we build these mechanisms to protect ourselves. So basically, we put shell on shell on shell on shell until, as you said, you're fucking almost impenetrable to anyone else. You know, so you've got the trust issues, you've got this, you've got that. And then why do we end up in the fucking army or in fucking jail or in some bikie gang or in whatever other fucking club, but generally with the same sort of people doing some, you know, whether it's fairly untoward things or things, something that's giving you a fix and something that brings you guys together because you're the only ones doing it, whether it's high risk, highly illegal, you know, like special forces and bikie gangs, there's no direct correlation there, but they're kind of fucking, you know,
structured in a similar way.
There's some things going
loyalty,
on there.
Respect, brotherhood. Yeah. And
so, you know, those, you know, like to me, when I look back now and there's a couple of turning points, and even since I've got out, it's like, I'm either going to do some really fucking good shit now or I will fucking end up in jail. And I can't justify that, but it's like you're literally at a T intersection. It's kind of not a roundabout where there's five or six ways off with most of the blokes I know like us. It's like you're either going to go that way or fucking that way.
Yeah,
I might just dabble over here a little bit.
No, you're on or you're off.
You know, it's either I'm going to fucking muck up or, you know, and like you've done, you know, turn your life around and try and do, you know, good and use, you know, what you've learnt, your life lessons, you know, call them fuck ups, call them whatever. I mean, I'm comfortable to say that I fucked up a lot of shit. That's what I know to do.
Absolutely. And I think it's learning. I mean, people often say to me, oh, do you regret this and that? And I'll say it once again. I don't regret it because, you know, for me, I wouldn't be sitting here with you right now delivering this podcast to all you wonderful people out there in the audience about to listen. It just wouldn't have happened. Mm. So our paths are set in the way they are. Whether you want to accept it or not, well, that's up to you. But until you understand it and start to take a little bit of fucking self-hold and put your hand up, and, mate, No one's fucking perfect. I mean, what's perfect?
Totally agree.
You know, I don't want to be perfect even now. Mm. I'll always be 95%. I'll still take a piss in the street and I'll still go and fucking do whatever I want to do because that's life.
Yeah, and when you say, like, what's perfect, I use the exact same, but different, same, is like when people, like, go, oh, that's not really normal. I'm like, well, fucking show me the book on normal.
Who's normal?
Especially nowadays.
Oh, I don't get it.
When it's normal for you, and I'm not racist or sexist or any of this fucking rubbish, but if you think it's normal for you to, you know, be undecided as to what sex you are each day, because that's where we're at now.
Yeah, that's
you know, and again, world. I'm not having a go at those people. I'm just calling it for what it is. Society has considered that acceptably normal.
Any paperwork you fill out these days, H, you've got an option.
Yeah.
Who, Mr. or Mrs. Or other?
Yeah.
Or what? Anyway.
So I'd rather be, what I think's happening is it's doing a full 180 degrees, you know, like what used to be normal is now not normal.
Yeah.
You know, like if you're a fucking man, oh man, and you want to protect your family and you do this and you do that, it's like you're a bit extreme. You know what I mean? I'm like, you know,
you're not normal.
Yeah, exactly.
That
you whereas you look back at the older days and fucking Vikings and these tribes and that tribes. I mean, we've been doing this shit for 1,000 years.
Fuck! Look at the Irish.
You know, but people seem to, you know, they're on a faster spin of things, so they will look back only maybe 10 years ago and go, "Oh, we weren't doing that then." It's like, as creatures, we're fucking still hardwired.
Yes.
You know, from 1,000 years ago, however long ago.
Let's go back, H, to that 17-year-old young fella from Toowoomba.
Mm. So, yeah, like I said, went down. So once you join, you go straight to basic training, which is in Kapuka. Was then and it still is now. And
is that Canberra or Victoria?
Kapuka's in near Wagga Wagga.
Wow.
Having a geographic fucking... I don't
someone like you should be able to mentally have a GPS.
So for those who are listening, I can put a rocket in a fucking window anywhere in the world, but I don't know where I did basic training. Anyway, you spent a few months there, and that was, I actually loved it there because it was so, like, back then, you know, a lot of people compare. I don't compare back then to now. We've changed for many reasons on how we do things, and a lot of them are good, I hate to say it, but. Yeah, you know, when we went through training back then, you know, it was, you know, if you stuffed up, you know, you'd know that you stuffed up, we'll put it that way. Whereas now, you know, things might be considered, you know, softer or lighter. I try to avoid those terms, but it's very, very fucking different now. We'll say that. But yeah, a couple of months there, and like I said, I loved it because, you know, straight away, just the immediate bonding of the brotherhood, you know, how they strip everyone back and there's a method to all their madness, you know, like everyone will shave their fucking head, you know, not like now where you get a choice of how short you want it. It's like,
is that how it is now?
I think they get like different options now and a few different things. You know, it's not like everyone just fucking gets marched in and you just, irrespective.
I always thought that everybody is identically the fucking same. Like you say, everybody is stripped of everything and you all start at zero.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit more flexibility there on a few things. But, you know, there's that and the uniformity and just every single thing you're doing. What that does, and again, you don't really realise it at the time, and it might sound really obvious now to someone else, but it just puts you immediately on a level playing field. You know, like if you look at me and you now, you know, you're wearing your sneakers, I'm wearing my boots. This is my comfort shit. That's your comfort shit. Like this is our fucking personality and how we dress. If you go out for dinner tonight, you'll wear that. I'll wear whatever I wear. So when you take that away from someone, you know what I mean? It takes them a little bit out of their comfort zone. And there's a lot of psychology behind it and it's quite well founded. So I actually enjoyed that, you know, because all you're then able to do is do like the best you can
do with what you've got.
And the only thing that'll fucking separate you, and this is where it gets, you know, a bit competitive, but in a good way, the only thing that separates you from the guy next to you is doing fucking better than him.
Yep.
You know, not like, oh, you've obviously got some money, so you're walking in the nice new Nikes and you got a fucking
or you come
Rolex
from a good family,
on your wrist.
We'll fucking give you a little bit of a slip
through. Yeah, you know, like all this sort of shit, or you've got better tucker than me. It's like, mate, we're eating the same fucking shit style white bread and the same stew, the same ill-fitting boots and you know what I mean? There's nothing. Yep. So when you start to do better than other people like that, and this is where the competitiveness, which I thrive off, you know, just creates that fucking culture straight away, you know, and it's quite good. And then as soon as you leave there, you think, you know, when I look back, you know, because I remember marching out, you literally think you're 10 foot tall and fucking bulletproof. 3 months of basic training, which now I think is hilarious. But then you go to Singleton to do the infantry basic training, which is, you know, another 3 months. And you're, you know, walking there to those instructors and you realise that you're fucking on the bottom of the barrel again, you know what I mean?
Yep.
And you really don't know fucking anything.
Yep.
And then you leave Singleton after 3 months doing all the you know, infantry specific stuff, and then you get to the battalion, to your unit, and you think you're 10 foot tall and bulletproof again. You walk in there and there's a fucking guy there that's been there 3 years and knocks you fucking straight on your ass, you know, for looking at him sideways.
Yeah, right.
So, and it just,
fuck,
you know,
it sounds like fucking, like jail. Really, like, you shut your mouth, you come in, you do your fucking time and go about your own business. Otherwise, yeah, you will cop a fucking smack in the mouth. Yeah. And you're guaranteed that.
Yeah. And there used to be a bit of that. Like, and some of it, to be honest, well, I don't condone it necessarily, but, you know, it was necessary. And other guys were just fucking bullies. But, like, you know, like every... you know, group or clique,
chain,
you know,
command,
it all sort of fucking gets around, you know what I mean? Everyone, yeah, everyone end up getting sorted out. And there wasn't like a lot of it. You know, there's certainly, you know, moments where if fucking guys, you know, did something wrong in that, you know, platoon or in that section or whatever, like, you know, the business was certainly fucking taken care of. And I know now that happens a lot less, and it shouldn't continue to happen, but, you know, when you're dealing with alpha males, you know, I'm not like a fan of saying that we should only do it this way, but, like, you know, when men deal with shit and they fucking deal with it, you know, as long as it's not done over the top or anything, it's done. And then...
shake hands, move on.
Yeah, most of the time, exactly. Yeah. You fucking shake hands and you move on.
That's right. And, so, and funny enough, I was raised in that way. You don't fucking kick him while he's down. Mm. Let the cunt get back up.
Yeah, and that's what I was kind of trying to say, exactly.
You know what I mean? No need to fucking carry on. Mm. You've done your 6 months. Where do you head to from here? I mean, for those that are listening that aren't familiar with the structure of the military.
Yeah, well, like I said, so once you get there, once you do your basic training, then you do your, what, specialist training, which is infantry. So you've already been in 6 or 7 months, and then you'll ask, you know, to go to whatever unit you want to go to. And that's generally based off, you know, locality or whatever. And, you know, certain units have certain reputations. And 1RAR being the 1st Battalion.
They're the troopers?
Yep.
Yeah,
up in,
I had a mate that did that in Timor.
Yeah, up in Townsville. You know, for a few different reasons, you know, that's where I wanted to go. And back then they were like, you know, certainly as far as all the infantry units go, you know, had a very, very good and proud reputation. So
they're like the first line, they drop in and...
Yeah, yeah. Well, they don't parachute in, that's 3RR, but, oh, you know, that's the same... No, it's all good. That's the same sort of thing, you know. So they were called the Operational Deployment Force. We're on the shortest notice to move and all this sort of, you know, riffraff. Anyway, you get there and you just fast, you know, settle into this, you know, way of life. And that, it's not till you've sort of been there a little while till you really... sort of click into soldiering, if you know what I mean, and this whole culture and lifestyle starts developing, because everything's fairly, you know, straight-legged, so to speak, at those basic trainings, whereas now, you know, you're starting to have instants and you're starting to, you know, you're allowed a lot more freedom, so you're hanging out in this brotherhood, you know, you're going everywhere with each other. So when shit goes down, as in whether it's with your mates, missus, or a fight at the pub on Friday night or fucking whatever it is, like, you know, so you start really seeing that culture develop. And that's when I first really started to notice, you know, that fucking true brotherhood.
Yep.
You know, just like, as you know, mate, when you're in a fucking scrap, you know, who's fucking running and who's standing 100%. There with you? As in, you know, the guy there that hasn't got a fucking mark on him going, yeah, I was there, boys. And it's like, well, fuck,
mate. I got you. Fuck yeah, it's bro. Kind of, high five. Yeah.
It's kind of like, we're all busted up, mate. I don't know how you haven't got a fucking scratch, but anyway.
Yeah, no. I'm fucking sweet, mate. I didn't get one on me. Yeah. Fucking leaving.
So, yeah, a lot of that sort of stuff goes on, and then, you know, the girls start to get involved, as in, you know, all the drama there, and it just sort of grows, I think, you know. And plus, you know, you do trips away overseas, and, you know, all the shenanigans kind of fucking start. So you're really getting that, like I said, you're really starting to feel and see that there's a culture here, and then the clicks start, as in, you know, certain groups, you know, become, you know, that group, and you just get tighter and tighter in that group, and the groups become fucking smaller and smaller,
yeah, right,
the more sort of shit you go through. And then that group might be given a little name or has got a fucking reputation or whatever, you know. But generally speaking, you know, back then, most of the, you know, platoons or sections and that, you're pretty tight.
You know, slouch, you know. So you've gone in there with a mindset. You know who you want to be from a young age. A lot of these blokes are just happy, I guess, to have made it through.
Yeah.
They've got a job. They're going to represent their country if that's their passion and what they're truly there for. You had bigger plans, didn't you?
Yeah, and like I said, right from the start, I was there for a purpose, and like, I never, ever lost focus of that. So as soon as I could, I applied, and at the time, the only Special Forces unit in Australia, as in combat unit, was SASR, the Special Air Service Regiment over in Perth. So just before I was eligible, because back then you used to have to spend a bit of time in the unit, as in, you know, they wanted you at a certain age, they wanted you... you know, to have 3 or 4 years in the unit, you know, whatever is in. They basically didn't want you to be green.
So does that mean, though, that, okay, and I'm just asking this question out, don't want to sound naive, but this is a podcast and we're trying to inform
our listeners a little bit more on what it's about. Do I have to have deployed at any stage for me to then start to move further up in my career? Or is it, you know, the bloke that doesn't deploy, but like you say, he's on base for 3-4 years doing whatever he's doing?
Yeah, no.
How does that work?
Yeah, that's a good question. The deployments are like, when there are lots of deployments on, if someone was seen to be getting out of deployment, so to speak, so, you know, fucking malingering or anything like that, well, you know, that's heavily frowned upon and they'll be sort of fast pushed out. But if there's nothing going on, it's basically as long as you're participating as much as possible as you can in anything that's going on. So whether that's a, you know, an exchange with some Marines in Hawaii, or you're flying on this exercise, or you're doing this specialist course, you're doing a recon course, you're doing a sniper's course. So, you know, a few years of doing that, and then obviously you get a, you know, a reputation like anywhere or any organisation, really.
Someone with a bit of ticker and go, willing to have a crack.
And then, I tried to do, I'd also been in a little bit of strife by now, but funny enough, as you know, I'd been
strife
AWOL.
Strife in the military?
Yeah, I'd been AWOL a couple of times. Just fucking getting too pissed one night, or with some fucking, with someone I shouldn't have been with or whatever.
What's it like being brought back to base under, you know, military police?
And yeah,
you're in the fucking shit. Like, it's not like just going to the cop shop, is it?
Well, it's fucking funny because in the one thing that I fast realised in the military, and when you realise this your first time, you're probably only, well, maybe I made the mistake a few more times, but funny enough, but like, you know, you kind of like go, fuck.
To be the best, you got to be the best, eh, and everything.
And the point I was making is we get hit twice. So when, if you're on civilian street, as we call it, you know, and even if you're on the barracks and it's something really serious, but basically if I'm out and I'm caught in a fucking blue, and as what happened on one particular night, and then the Queensland coppers there, they grab you, and they'll fucking throw you in the clink.
Do you have to, by law, identify yourself as a soldier?
Technically, no, but up there we always would, because they'd fucking lean a bit either way.
Better to be known as...
It's basically fucking paperwork, no shit, and not having to go at the Queensland coppers, because back then, to be honest, you know, they weren't too bad, and I know a lot of them now. But they would... So, you know, if you identified yourself, they go back and throw you in there. But, like, really what I've worked out now, come back to fucking paperwork, which none of us like, right?
No.
And like I said, most coppers are fucking, you know, like us, they just took the right-hand turn.
Yeah.
So they would get on the phone and ring the military police to basically go, well, here's your fucking fella. You know, like, you look after shit and not even worry about really what we did. So then they'd take you back and then...
Did that concern you, though? Like, as a sort of new, up-and-coming soldier, you know, getting your feet in there and, you know, all of a sudden, fucking boom.
Yeah,
here
no,
comes the MPs too.
Yeah, no, definitely. Like, later years, I certainly wasn't scared of them because I've probably been around them too much. But, and as a young fella, you're
are they given similar training?
Now I'd say their training's better. I'm not going to fucking start ragging them out, but, like, I'm not a fan of the military police.
Yep.
You know, I think this is just my personal view, just fucking straight up. If you're going to join the police force... Join the police force. If you're going to join... And I respect everyone who joins the Army, the Navy, or the Air Force. Like I said, this is just how I look at it, and I don't mean it as harsh as it probably comes across. To me, if you're going to join the Army, and that's what I'm saying, is my opinion, if you're going to join the fucking Army, join the Army to fight.
Yep.
Like, if I want to be a nurse, but, like, you know, I respect those people who do that because they're still joining the military.
Yes.
So that's just my mindset. It's probably a bit... Like, I'm fairly lateral, but on that, it's actually fucking narrow, you know what I mean?
What do you think, though, with the way that the military is structured today with all... Like, it can run itself completely without civilians, can't it?
Oh, no, there's lots of civilians integrated now into different positions.
Yes, sorry, that's where I'm heading with is, you know, you're not just joining to fight now, like, you know.
Yeah.
You're joining because you're a fucking tradie. You're joining because you're a nurse, like you said.
Yep.
You know, you're a lawyer.
Mm. And we need all different types, and that's what I'm saying. Like, I've never had, like, a you know, chip about anyone else in the fucking military. Quite the contrary, actually. But you know, just for, like I said, for me, and so I don't know whether I'm wording it right, so to speak. But you know, I joined the fucking military. I'm like, there's only one place or one thing you can fucking join to do that, and that's the military. That's the Army. That's Special Forces. I hear different things all the time of, like, you'll run into some fellow and they'll go, you know, I tried to join for this, blah, 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 and they knocked me back. And, you know, I'm sure there's something there, but, like, sometimes I'm sure there's probably not either. Like, did some, because then you hear of other ones when they repercharge it or, you know, rebut the, you know, they got declined and they'll you know, go back and challenge it, and then they get accepted. Like, I mentor a few people.
Okay.
As in that, who want to join, and a lot of young kids and stuff, and just, you know, talk to them, you know, through my money on one social media, but through that platform, as in Instagram. And I'll talk to them, and they'll send me DMs and whatnot, and I'm like on one particular case, you know, like one of the fittest fucking, and this guy wanted to join Special Forces, and, you know, it's a bit of a Melbourne Cup racer, it can be, there's so much behind the scenes, but I was like pretty confident that this guy was like fucking A-grade material. And I'd got to know him over a year or so. And he was a bit older, like he was in his late 20s. You know, they said there was some fucking thing wrong with his fitness or something wrong with this. And I'm like, man, I've seen guys join that were nowhere near as fucking fit or as strong as this fella. So, you know, basically, I guess when the whole, it's like making a fucking cake, you know, they need every single piece of the ingredients in the pot. Make. And if one thing, you know, like if you miss that sprinkle of baking soda, the fucking thing doesn't rise. Yeah. And I've never been, to be fair, never been behind the scenes in what's called recruiting, where they have these fucking magic formulas and shit going on. So I actually don't know.
Yeah,
cool. But exactly what you said then, I've heard many, many times. And then on the same token, you know, on several occasions, you know, you'll be in a group or whatever doing something and there's a guy there, you're like, how the fuck did he get in?
Let's talk about the next stage.
So we'll probably jump ahead to doing the actual selection course.
Mm.
So what happened, just to go back one step, is because we started talking about fucking trouble, the short story is, you know, when I went to join SASR, because I'd recently had a DUI, a couple of AWOL charges and I think an assault charge or fucking something. Anyway, they're like, well, this fella's obviously a little bit hot-headed and needs to fucking cool down. So they said, look, you know, apply in another year or so, or words to that effect. Now, in that time, a trip come up to go overseas. I can't remember where it was. It might have been Hawaii or Rifle Company Butterworth, and whenever those trips come up, like, you know, because the selection course is there every year, so if you get put on even an overseas deployment or some other junket for 6 months somewhere, like, you always fucking jump at that and then come back and do what you were going to do.
Yep.
So anyway, that happened, and then by the time I come back, which is now, we're in 1997-ish, and a mate said, you know, sort of tipped me off that they're going to raise another full-time Special Forces unit, being a commando unit down in Sydney. And look, I can't, you know, exactly remember, you know, why. I certainly remember a couple of things as in why I chose that path then. It was like, I just thought it'd be better and fresher being something new. It'd be really fucking pioneerish as in we're starting something from scratch. And just the couple of good contacts I had as in sources, so to speak, you know, I had some really good positive things to say. Like, this is fucking
supportive, you know, of what you want.
Yeah, yeah, so, okay, to, so cool. To get into something at the sort you of ground, that, you know.
Yep.
Even though SASR is, you know, a fantastic fucking unit, you know, they've been around. And because this is, you know, well before 9/11, you know, no one was really doing much. So it was like, you know, why go to Perth? And to be honest, I didn't want to fucking live on the other side of the world. And whereas this unit was being raised in Sydney, Eastern Seaboard, I was like, you know, I'll give this a crack. It just was a bit more exciting, knowing that I could go there. And then if I wanted to, I could still then, you know, go to Perth.
You know, how many would be selected for that special?
So that we call us the fucking 0.01% club.
Yeah.
So basically, and I've ran the actual selection course, so I have got a very, very good idea of what, you know, I know what the fuck goes on behind the scenes, is what I'm trying to say. What happens is we'll get, so across the Australian Defence Force, so all Navy, Army, Air Force, we'll get 300 or so applicants a year generally.
Right across.
Yep. Okay, so they're cut down to be legitimate applicants, as in that they tick all the right boxes, right? And then so far, we're just looking at, we're really looking at paperwork, essentially. Yeah. That's what's landing on someone's desk. Then out of that 300-odd, we start, because we only have a manageable figure, and there'll be things that we find in that paperwork or through phone interviews that we can just cross some fucking guy out for, or now guy or girl. So then we generally get off the bus and we have like a little reserve group. So we need that number that steps off the bus to be like literally exactly 100 or 120 pending. And
this is after your 300 selections being reduced?
Yep.
Okay.
So now we've got, so we like, that's called, you know, the paper board or paper cut, sure, or any words to that effect, because like I said, you might talk to them on the phone, might not even bother. So now on the actual day, the start day of the fucking race is in selection, so to speak, when the bus pulls up with them all on it, there'll be about 100, 120. That's our aim and mark, because we know what the attrition rate is. And then essentially you'll go through, you know, the selection course, which, you know, varies so much in shape and size over the years from, and it's all relevant. So just to explain that a little bit, what I mean is when you join any of these units, and every special ops fucking unit in the world pretty well does this, the first thing that occurs, like I said, when I refer to getting off the bus, and when you hear this term, selection course, the first thing that occurs is an extremely fucking intense period of time. Now, that period of time can be 5 days, can be 15 days, it can be 21 days. And what happens there, so to bring out, to find out fucking how much gumption a guy's got, there's a few things that you do to them, and it's fucking really simple, but it's not. There's also a lot of mastery behind it. And that is, so immediately, you know, we'll get them very tired. That's easy. Physical activity.
So fatigue.
Yep. So fatigue, but in particular, don't let them fucking sleep.
Yep.
Don't let them eat.
So their body's starting to fight against their mind already.
Yep. We might run, and we've ran everything from a fucking 7-day course to a 2-week course to a 3-week course to a 4-week course. Like,
so your 7-day course is getting in the fucking ring and fighting for the whole fucking 12 rounds non-stop.
Basically, you know, full like on, maybe have a minutes. Fucking, maybe have an hour of sleep.
Yeah,
and
30
you know,
second
like
rate
you're
back
literally
into it.
Yep. Absolutely destruction.
Yep.
And what happens through that process is, you know, personalities and certain characteristics and attributes, you know, come to the light. They come to the floor. So any person, like if you meet a fellow and you're fucking talking to him for a couple of hours, you know, like you can get a bit of a feel for someone, especially, you know, when like guys are like, you know, us who have been around the block a little bit, got a little bit of age behind us, you know when a guy's bullshit and all. But a lot of people don't actually have that. They'll go, oh, he's a fucking good fellow. And we'll be going, I wouldn't fucking trust him. You know what I mean?
100%.
You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
So anyway, so the more duress you put a person under, okay, the more real him or her you're seeing.
So, yeah,
and yep. So we, you know, when I say we simply do that by, you know, a lot of extremely physical, arduous or hard activities. We do that by another method, which is basically mindfuck exercises. So what would mindfuck exercise be? You know, you might have just ran 20Ks. I haven't given you any food fucking for 3 days. We haven't slept. And what do we do then? This is one of our favourite ones, though, by the way.
I like the 20. Look on your face, Danny. He had a big smile on his face.
Bring him into this fucking room.
Fucking half a stiffy over that one,
Put fucking 20, put 20 kilos of white rice on the floor and put 20 kilo bag of fucking black rice on the floor and just mix it all up together and tell them they've got to fucking separate them.
You're fucking kidding
so
me.
So there's nothing physically hard about that.
But it's long and it's
but
enduring.
If there is one fucking grain of black rice in with that white rice, like they'll go for another 20Ks.
Oh, fuck.
Or whatever it might be. So there's guys, and like I said, remember, they're already fatigued. So now you're watching them and me and you are down there on
well,
our hands and knees.
You become delusional. You start fucking to see this, two and three of the one fucking thing.
Yeah, they can't even
you
see
think
the rice.
You're pulling it out.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. And you're not actually touching the fucking rice.
100%. And then you'll bump me or I've just found a little bit of black rice. And you accidentally, or you might even fall over asleep or anything, and then I'll drop it in there. So how I react to that, because see, this is the thing. Operationally, we're fucking tired. We've seen people to shoot. There's a lot going on. You might have someone injured. You might have a guy fucking dead in a bag next to you. You've got to carry out. You've got to put him down. You've got to have a rest. Like, and you know, it's only later you realise all this stuff.
So by you staying heart rate down, breathing controlled, pick your mate up.
Yeah.
Come on, bud. Let's
get
this done.
Yep.
Don't worry about the fucking 50 that just fell into the white again. Start back. Get back to
so
it.
So you'll see a guy. And remember, the whole time, there's 20 of us fucking standing around watching them. And when we're not watching them, we're watching them.
Even
fucking,
that's a head fuck. Yeah, no, you're all sitting there with so smirks on your face.
We'll either have them under fucking cameras. So if they think we're not there, we're there. Like,
yeah.
They're being observed every fucking thing they do. And there'll be a couple of psychologists watching as well. And everything we see or do or observe, we're writing down. So that example you gave then is actually a really good one where, you know, that fella, okay, so just say it's you. You go, hey, mate, fucking, here's a bit of rice and you help him. Like, okay, you know, tick, you know, and that'll be noted. Just quickly, you know, what you did or said or whatever. Yeah, but the other guy might go, for fuck's sake, mate. You know, and he might try and whisper it under his breath, but he's like having a go at him. It's like, it's not that guy's fault necessarily. And even if it is, it's like if you see footy players, right? You know, when someone makes a fucking mistake.
Hands up.
What do they fucking all do? They go over and fucking give him a good go and tap him on the ass.
That's
all right, mate, don't fucking worry about it.
I told this to my son just recently because he asked the question, why is that guy that just cost them the game, you know, dad, you know, with 3 minutes to go,
why is he getting a pat on the fucking
and
back?
And I said, because that's about acceptance and moving forward.
Exactly.
We don't dwell on it. We don't fucking, they're brothers, they're buddies, mate, it's all good. Mm. He's put his hand up. He's accepted it. Team's accepted it. Mm. Continue moving forward. Let's win the fucking game.
And same as boxers, you know, and this is where the whole psychology, and see, I love the whole sociology, fucking psychology, the small team dynamics. So when you see like boxers, there's another fucking good example. Everyone thinks boxers are fucking arrogant and full of themselves. You can't go into that boxing ring with any, you know, fucking element whatsoever of doubt. You know what I mean? So where they're all just so pepped up, you know, it's like you think of us getting on a Black Hawk. So I know, you know, there's 10 of us on that fucking Black Hawk. We're flying in. There's like 30 or 40 guys on the other end waiting to fucking kill us. You know, so you don't have a mindset like, oh, hope fucking Simo's all right tonight, or you're going to be okay, mate. It's like, let's fucking do this.
Yeah, we're
you
on.
You know, and you're fucking up here.
Yep.
Every, you know, it's 101%, as I say, 100% of the time. So, you know, coming all the way back now to the selection course and mindset. So, when I was on, you know, my selection course, I actually, you know, yeah, was there parts, you know, that I didn't enjoy. You know, that's fucking pain. But when I look back, and you know, I really fucking enjoyed, you know, all the little things and just having the ability most of the time. And, you know, I'm relatively happy to, and comfortable to say this. You know, I did sort of do very well on my course. I know that because you're told that. And you get a report like a scorecard after your fucking selection course. And it was then, and I knew, you know, I'd learnt myself a bit by now, but no worries.
That's what I was just about. I'm getting excited. I'm looking at you. No, because I'm going to refer back to that young boy with a vision, with a dream.
Mm.
You already have your mental game in hand.
Mm.
You know they're going to fuck with you. You know that you're going to be absolutely fucking broken and rebuilt. You were ready for that. As much as I'm sure that it pushed you to the absolute boundaries, but you had already set yourself a task and a goal that was going to happen. Mm. You were not failing.
Mm. But like, as you know, and then before the podcast for the listeners, you know, Simo was telling me some of the things he's done, which I think is amazing, like right across Australia and shit. So when it's not until you do it, though, so until you get it. So, for example, when you're on the selection course and now, you know, you're like, fuck me, you know what I mean? You peel your boot off. Like, for example, mine, they changed the distances over the years, but when I did my course, the speed march is in the march that one of the, you have certain tests on it and everything else is just fuckery. But you used to have to do this 30-kilometer pack march. So 30 kilometers with about 30, 35 kilograms total weight on your body. And I think it was under fucking 4 or 5 hours. I can't remember, to be honest.
So what's that a pace for people out there that...
Well,
with a
fucking pack on, you know, you got to be covering, you know, I think 7, 8 fucking kilometers or something per hour, whatever it was.
And so 8.
I might have fucked that up,
seven
but anyway.
And a half, 8.
I'll work it out. I'll text it to you later. Anyway, when I came in, and me and my buddy, we were fucking neck to neck, and we were kind of helping each other, you know, as you do. And you don't do that much on selection. I never knew this. I'd only met this fella a couple of weeks before selection. And we bounced into each other, literally training up in the fucking hills one day. What are you doing? And you're all like, you know, what are you? I'm doing selection. Yes, so am I. And then we just started walking together, and we got along really well. Anyway, you know, I come across the line first. He was a couple of meters behind me, so I consider us both coming across first. But see, when you do something like that and you're the first fucking guy across, you know, and you peel your boot off and just fucking like pour fucking blood out of it and see the whole skin of your feet, but you didn't even feel or see any of that. I think that's, for me, when the coin starts to drop that and you know they're putting you under a bit of, you know, additional scrutiny. They're like, fuck, how good is this guy? And then later, and I know all this now because later when I ran it, you know, I'd be like, yeah, if you're doing really well, this is where there's a fine art to fucking, when guys ask me for advice, you know, when they do selection, it's like, if you do really, really well, like if you look like you're a bit of a gun on there, then I'm going to fucking load you up more.
Oh, obviously.
You know, like, okay, you're getting a bit cocky, you know what I mean?
Let's see how far you can go. Because we want and then, to see what you're actually worth.
So the fucking key, not that I was trying to do that, because I only learned this later.
Just do your best.
Yeah, you actually want to be in the middle of the fucking pack, right? And it might sound really obvious.
No, I fucking get that.
But you also got to be doing your fucking best,
yes.
Right? Because if you, you know,
top 10%
is good. Yeah, it's like if you look at the Melbourne Cup, right? You know, imagine that fucking horse going, I'll just sit back here for a minute, be fucking next minute I'm losing the race. You know what I mean? So things can happen and unfold like really quickly. So to sort of, and like I said, I didn't really realise this. Like, I knew just to basically shut my fucking mouth and do the best I could. But when I started to finish a few things first, and, you know, I was standing there, I was quite fucking proud. Not cocky, but I was quite proud there. And then I realised, like, I was starting to get a bit of heat. Like, it's like, you know, who's this fucking... Yeah, who's he think he is?
Yeah, yeah.
And then next minute, the next thing you're doing, you're fucking giving extra weight or something. So there's no, you know, it's not like then it becomes...
You can't escape the fact that you have this
and
natural
talent. And like I said, there's so much fucking scrutiny on you. Yeah. Like, you know, and you can hear him talking like that, and they would say it. And some, obviously now I know, because there's, if we say anything, some what I learned when I ran the selection course, if we fucking say anything that you can hear, we're doing it on purpose.
Yes.
Like, whereas people think, oh, they've picked up a little bit of information or whatever. It's like, mate, we fucking
it's
told you that.
It's another blind game, isn't it?
Yep, so then you go and tell them, but that's not what's going to fucking happen. Or that's just what we want you to believe. And the same thing, because one of the biggest fuckeries you can do, and coming back onto the psychology of it, where we started to talk about some of the things before, is, you know, what one of my little favourite fucking tricks was to be, like, right in their face, because that's what they're expecting, right? So we're fucking yelling at them, at whether they're in the pool and they're half drowning, or whether they're marching or pushing a fucking empty trailer up a hill with no wheels, like whatever it is. And you've got all these fucking instructors basically beasting around them. And then what I do, like the next day or next activity or whatever, I coined the phrase silent running. So they're waiting to be told or fucking, but no one, like not one single instructor, anyone says a single fucking word other than the basic directions. And those basic directions or commands, when we give them to them, we also give them in a different tone. So they're like, kind of...
Run,
yeah,
stop.
Yeah, literally. Walk. Like, pick your... And, but you'd say it's soft now because they're used to this other thing. It's like their heads literally don't know what the fuck's going on. Yeah. Be like, okay, what I want you all to do now is put your packs on and start walking down that road. And they're like... And they're like, okay, go. Just do that now. Oh, so then they actually start slowly doing it because they're used to fucking being yelled at and they react how you speak.
With your tempo with
so
a voice
they
like
slowly
that
put them on and then they just start sort of walking off. And we're just walking along with them, not saying a word. And you do that, like, you might fucking walk along with them for 6-7 hours and just hear, like, who's talking? Does someone go, look, hey, look, how much longer are we going to be doing this for? You know, just fucking anything. So as soon as there's that, someone speaks or says something or tries to buck up against it, or like, hey, fellas, let's sit down over here and have a rest. You know, some fucking good one-liners like that. You know, like, see how far that gets you. You know, so someone will fucking say, like, it's human nature, like, because the single biggest thing which fucks with a human's mind, and of all the thing, and that's where it doesn't matter, I've seen, like, the biggest, toughest, strongest fucking guys get off the fucking bus. What humans can't fucking handle is not knowing. So when I say to you, start walking.
Where are we going?
And you can walk for 5 minutes. You can walk for 2 hours. But just, and if I say we're going to walk for 2 hours, you'll walk fucking 2 hours. Even if your fucking leg's broken, you'll walk 2 hours. Like, both me and you could snap our legs down and say, okay, got to crawl a kilometre, we'll crawl a kilometre.
That's right.
But if we say crawl, at 500 metres, mate, we'll fucking stop and we're like, well, fuck this. Because you don't, like, how far, I need to know, you know what I mean? And that's how the mind works. So that's one of the other, you know, big factors that we use is just the unknown, you know, like, okay, you know, go over there, stand there and wait. Fucking how long? You know, jump on the truck, get off the truck, fucking hop back on the truck. Like, you know, so that unknown just creates, you know, angst.
And is that something that's just purposely done? And,
oh,
and,
fuck yeah.
You know, left, yeah,
we
like
know,
that for as
we
long
know what
as
we're
you,
doing.
Yeah, as long as you guys want to make that happen.
Yeah.
So,
and other
off.
Times there's fucking,
fuck
you know, there's this environment thing where we'll like
I wouldn't last that bit. I'd be like, what the fuck am I doing?
So the other thing
fuck
is
off, Simo. See ya.
So Simo's that guy. We just worked it out.
Oh, no, that's only telling you what you need
joking.
To hear right now.
Hey, if everyone could keep that to themselves out there.
Oh, wow.
It's all good. But yeah, it takes all different types, and there's no, like, a lot of people like, you know, is it this type or is it that type? And that's the other thing you learn, you know, it's not this guy, it's not that size guy. There's so much mindset, you know, involved. And we need all of them too. Like, there is a bit of a stereotype there, of course, but when you see a bunch of guys, you know, yeah, you'll get all those sort of stockier, burly, fucking stern-looking, staunch-looking guys, but you'll also get that little fella or that softer-looking fella. Yeah, and then they've got through and they're fucking, you know what I mean? We saw something in them and you know, 99.9% of the time, like, we're right.
So you get, obviously, accepted.
Mm-hmm.
You pass. What happens next for H?
So that was at the end of 98, and basically what you do, there's a series of courses you do, and essentially it goes, and it's the same for SASR, it's the same for two commands, it's the same most units in the world. You do about a year's worth of fucking training. So even when you finish that, you're under scrutiny.
So is this off the back of already 4 years attendance within the army?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So you do another year of specialist courses. Because you do all specialist shooting courses, specialist driving courses, counter-terrorism courses, anti-terrorism courses, fast boat courses, swimming courses, diving courses, climbing cliff courses, fucking sniper courses, fucking... It just keeps fucking going. You know, photography courses, it depends what... You know what I mean?
Oh, so, yeah, okay, yeah.
So for the whole year,
they're making you now, you know, as we call it, boning you up and skilling you up, you know. And then by the
backpack full of fucking intelligence.
Yeah. You know, close protection courses, you know, because we're responsible for when the prime ministers and other, you know, important people go overseas. You know, we're the ones fucking looking after them. You know, information collection courses, all these things. So basically for 12 months, you're doing all this specialist training and different courses. So even though you've passed selection, and when you finish selection, they're like, you know, you've passed, but it's not until like the fucking end that you actually get your beret and you're allowed to go into the unit. So then you're, you know, classified as what they're called, an operator. As in, even though you've done so much in the army,
yep,
and then you've done a year's worth of fucking training.
Do you think that's more, you know, as what I would call lived experience?
Yeah, 100%.
Which,
you know,
which, as I've always said, you know, throughout my life, the value of someone's lived experience outweighs any fucking textbook.
100%. And then, you know, to fast forward, and we'll come back and forth a bit, but just to stay on that note, if you fast forward, then after 9/11 happened, you know, because then we were basically in non-stop fucking combat from the minute that happened. So, you know, there's a few little things going on, and they were using the Australian Special Forces to do a bit of stuff in, a bit of stuff there. But
more reconnaissance
but
stuff?
But fucking or? After 9/11, you know, it was non-stop combat. So then you can imagine 3 or 4 years into 9/11, okay, so now we're into like 2006, 7, 8 or whatever, and you're that guy that comes off that reinforcement cycle. So now you're an operator. You've just done your selection. You've done your 12 months fucking training and all these fucking different skills. And you walk into the unit and you're walking around amongst guys
that have been ready to go fucking, for fucking a long time.
And they had done their second, third, fourth fucking combat tour.
Yep.
So, you know, you can, like, so then they're like, fuck, you know, and then
Is it a bit of a thing, H, where, and I know leadership's a massive thing there, but also too, from the outside looking in, would assume that you'd have to have some nous, some of your own intelligence to be able to get the job done. You know?
That's actually an excellent point, mate, and it's probably something we don't emphasise enough, and definitely something I skimmed totally through before, not deliberately, but, you know, that your aptitude, your intelligence is also tested, and there's different ways we test that. The mindset and psychology and you know, a bit of a buzzword in our community, you know, is the resilience levels. So we need to, excuse me, we need to test, which is really difficult to do, so don't ask me particularly how we do that, but, you know, because it's done directly by the psychologist and, yeah, and a bunch of other observations, we'll say, but we need to get as sure as we can, and you'll never be 100%, but to be as sure as we can that that guy's got very, very high levels of resolve. Now, what does that mean? I'll give you an example where there's three guys can be standing, on a job together. So they're just outside a compound or whatever. And then just say coming outside of running one of the doors comes up, you know, a small child which has got a suicide pack strapped to him. You know, just say it's a fucking 12-year-old girl and it goes off. So those three guys all see that. They're right in the same proximity. It doesn't hurt them. They're far enough away or whatever. But they see the same thing is the point I'm making. Now, those three guys will all have a different reaction.
Yep.
So this is where, you know, it doesn't get hard. Well, it gets hard to explain, but not really. Also, so we don't know because you can't test that. So we can test. We can try to test and build resilience. We can, you know, make them do hundreds of fucking tick flick and Q&A things that are put into an algorithm on a fucking psychologist's computer and blah, blah, blah. But at the end of the day, until
you're
that
in
happens,
that fucking position.
And then, you know, you've got the, you know, bucket of water full theory, and that is, that can happen to one guy. He can come back and have to check out, which is fine, as in, you know, he'll start to have some sort of associated issues.
PTSD sort of thing. Yep.
And then the other guy might be fine. He might go back and do another trip. Might be, nothing might happen to him, but now he needs to deal with that and come back and realize he's doing some silly things. The other guy might have another fucking 10 severe incidents happen near him and it never affect him. So the point being is, you know, that's a extremely hard thing for us to select against. We try through that selection course and the skills course, as I spoke about that year-long piece, you know, we try to do other little activities within there to get some sort of reading of that. But ultimately, you know, we fucking can't. And this is where the whole problem, not problem, but this is where, you know, issues rise where, you'll hear the term PTSD, which, oh, by the way, is a very misunderstood term, in my opinion. We can talk more about that later. But basically, they'll have, you know, any number of things can start, you know, going wrong. And to add another layer on top of that, when that guy did selection, you know, he may have had something already happen in his life. So his bucket was already at fucking half, quarter, or three quarters.
That's just thrown him over the edge.
You know what I mean? So this is the thing, you know, that you can, there's only so many questions you can ask a guy.
Is it like you seek emotional detachment within that soldier?
Mm.
And obviously, you know, there'll be certain things, and I mean, we don't need to go right in the depths of that. We can only imagine that during training could be quite heartfelt points where you'll trigger, and you will know straight away by the look in that bloke's eyes or his demeanour or his body language where you hit a soft spot. And that may be not even within cooey of what the reality of what will be. Like you just said, a young girl comes out of a door strapped with a suicide vest, you know.
And there's all then different things, you're dead right, that can, you know, trigger those feelings and sensations, you know, and then, and this is where it just gets so complex, you know, and then when they come home, you know, are they in a good, secure family environment, you know, what coping mechanisms were they using, you know, earlier in their life? Like in my life, for example, I never fucking touched drugs my whole life, you know, I was never one of those kids as a young fella who partied, like I literally didn't fucking touch anything.
Yeah.
You know, I used to have a few drinks, you know, and used to do this, blah, blah, blah. But then, you know, later on, you know, because then this is when the coping mechanisms start.
Absolutely.
And whether that's fucking fast women, fast cars, you know, the recreational drugs, you know, the alcohol and or combination of all of the above and pharmaceutical drugs. Yep. So.
And I think, H2, you'd be finding a few and far between to if everybody was honest with themselves.
Mm.
That's gone through some sort of trauma in their life that hasn't touched on or experienced, like you said, at least one of those fucking things.
Yeah, another nail you hit then, mate, I know we're jumping around a little bit, but was the...
It's the clink, mate, it's organic and it ain't fucking scripted.
No, I love it. Is that honesty piece to yourself. And one thing I learnt, and I'll admit, you know, for years, now when I look back, because, you know, that's what retrospect... The power of you know, retrospective thoughts, thinking, and analysis is, you know, I fucking wasn't honest, you know, and I was fucking one of the more in touch fellas, years in with self that I know. So I look at other fellas, I'm like, fuck, mate, you're a mile away from where you think you are. And what I mean by that was, you know, when I look back now, I started to use different coping mechanisms, you know, after I don't know, fucking third, fourth trip, probably fucking 10th significant incident or whatever. And, you know, started to do things that I'd never done before. Now, whether that's fucking, you know, drinking or using something or doing other things, because some of the coping mechanisms aren't, like, as obvious. Like, there's a lot of people that overtrain in the gym. They fucking destroy themselves in the gym. Like, they're actually trying to hurt themselves. That's a coping mechanism.
Yeah.
How you fucking drive your motor vehicle, your car, coping mechanism.
Yep.
You know, how much danger, basically, you seek. You know, when you cross a road... And, you know, you'll walk out and you'll take a step and that truck will go past fucking an inch from your face. People are like, fucking, well, what are you doing, mate? So I don't know. I felt that was cool.
Yep.
So what we're trying to get there is it's different feelings because you become so fucking void and numb. You know, I think I've said it in another podcast. You know, I can remember coming home and they're like, well, what does it feel like when you come home? I'm like, I'm in slow motion. Like, so I needed to speed shit up, literally. So
I like that word you just used, and I can relate to it.
Yeah.
Void and numb.
And another analogy I've said, you know, which I think was on the Life on the Line podcast, which is a fucking great, that was an accidental plug, but that's an actual great podcast too if you're into a lot of the military stuff to have a look at. But
what was it again? Just give it a wrap because I think it's important, especially for the, you know, folks out there that... you know, a lot of vets and stuff that they're talking with.
Yeah, so there's a podcast that's been out now a few years, and it's called Life on the Line. You know, we'll throw it up later or whatever, I'm sure Simo will. And what it's done is it's interviewed a lot of veterans. So, you know, there's a lot of amazing, and he's got hundreds out now. I'm on there 5 times, I think. There's a lot of amazing stories on there. And not just what I love about it is such a diverse audience on there. Sorry, diverse... interviewee,
yeah.
Whatever the fucking right word is.
I had a listener because I was just, you know, absolutely excited about who you were. But as I said to you earlier, you know, like I just skimmed over some things to get a picture of the man I was going to sit down with. I'm here now. This is where I want to be, you know.
Yeah.
But for anybody that does want to listen, that doesn't have this opportunity or experience to hear the clink, or it is a very open...
little bit more conservative.
Yep.
I think, and I guess probably recorded in a little bit of a military way.
Yeah, no,
that's how I would see.
Yeah,
it,
no, definitely. Like, Alex Lord's a guy who leads it, who's become a good friend of mine. I have fucking trust issues. That's no secret, and there's reasons for that. And then myself and Alex have become very good friends when he approached me. You know, obviously, that was the first podcast I ever did. So it was a huge thing for me to actually do it, let alone talk about some of the stuff. But anyway, I remember using an analogy. I think it was on one of the episodes on there, you know, about the racing car. And, you know,
was that the addiction?
Yeah, and when I was saying before,
driving fast,
about being numb, it's like, you know, we're geared up. So when you transition, when you're in the unit, you know, you've got to be 101% fucking dedicated 100% of the time. Like, there's just zero error or breathing space for fucking anything else. And it's a lifestyle. It's not a fucking job. You know, whenever that phone rings, whenever someone calls you, you know, whatever a fucking mate asks you to do, and I mean whatever he asks you to do in the world, whether you're overseas, when you're back in Australia, like, you know, you're there like that. And when someone else was asking me a question, they're like, you know, I said, well, you know, if you look at an F1 fucking driver's car, I mean, how fine-tuned and tweaked those things are.
Unbelievable.
So we're like that.
Yep.
Now, you can imagine fucking an F1 car. Me, if I gave it to you now and said, can you just run over to the fucking servo and put some gas in there? Like, it doesn't fucking work like that.
You won't even get it out of gear to get it there.
Yeah, like, so in between here and the service station, so if you use that analogy, so when next minute we find ourselves trying to walk around on the street like normal people, whatever the fuck they are, but, you know, you're just not normal. So it takes you years. You've basically got to start pulling that fucking F1 car down. And, you know, what's the first thing we need to do? Okay, well, we need to raise it a little bit because, as you know, they can't go over a fucking half an inch dot on the ground without blowing up.
Yep.
Then we need to change the tyres. And this is the process, which a lot of people don't understand, that we go through after we get out.
It's like an absolute detune, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a trend. And, you know, they call it the transition. And then there's, again, like, there's no rules or time limit or whatever. So a person might transition quite successfully, depending who he is and what he's done, in a month. You know, another guy, I think, in honesty, when I fucking look back now, I didn't even attempt to transition for about 3 years because I did a contract from Australia working with some people on a contract in Kabul, some Australian government stuff, and then for 2 years worked with some Americans doing some other stuff in about 13 different countries. And it was only then, you know, so I'm still working at quite a high tempo, doing, you know, a lot of similar things and different things to what I was doing before. And then it wasn't until I've gone, like, what the fuck is literally, like, you know, going on here? And then gone through also, again, a couple other heavier bouts in, you know, different coping mechanisms, which is just fucking not me. You know, don't get me wrong, love having a good time every now and then. But, you know, when you're doing shit every other fucking night, whether it's drinking or something else, like, you know, you've got a fucking problem.
Yeah.
So when I look back, and as I advise, you know, people now that I mentor and talk to, you know, that, you really need that break and allow yourself to acknowledge, you know, what transition looks like.
Well, that's part one of H, who was a commando for 24 years with the 2nd Battalion. Next week, we drop the second part.
And you heard these couple of explosions up in the forward left part of the jet. It's just called a jet, even though it's a helicopter. So once I felt those explosions up in that front component, and then I just took a knee and fucking, like, literally held on for dear life. And, and there was just a couple of people I wanted to say goodbye to, so I just, said a few things in my head. I'm not, you know, religious or anything like that, but it's kind of funny. The few times when I'm like, yeah, I'm fucking 100%, I'm fucking dead now. It's funny who you fucking reach out to, you know what I mean?
That's next week on The Clink, Real Stories of Redemption.
For the record, I'm done trying to make y'all comfortable. For the record, you ain't trying to grow, then it's done for you. For the record, lab on me going all the way. For the record, ain't trying to link, no time to waste. For the record.
Want to thank a new sponsor who's just come on board, Dr. Pickles Tattoo Aftercare and Lifestyle Products. They're made in Brisbane and are known right around the world. They have this amazing balm. It's called the Original Tattoo Balm. You seal and protect your tattoo with the OG. I've just been using it on my leg after I had it done, and I tell you now, my skin feels amazing and there's a great shine to it. They also have an antiseptic spray you can spray on and wipe over your tattoo to keep it nice and clean so you don't get any infections. They've got a 3-in-1 wash. It's all natural, smells great, packed full of peppermint, citrus, and wait for it, hemp oils. How good is that? Plus, they have a SPF 50 sunscreen, which acts as a moisturizer as well as protecting your tattoos from fading and stop them from getting sun damage. Right now, though, for the Clink listeners, they're offering 15% off with the code CLINK. Just head to drpickles.com. That's drpickles.com.